Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point. No one wants war with North Korea. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis says it would be catastrophic. But Mattis and the U.S. military have to plan anyway, carefully. The extraordinary taunting between President Trump and Kim Jong-un has ratcheted up diplomatic tensions. The recent false alarms in Hawaii and Japan show how quickly ordinary citizens can become terrified. This hour on Point, the Pentagon's quiet preparations for a war it doesn't want. Joining me first from Washington is Helene Cooper, Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times. Her latest story is titled, Military Quietly Prepares for a Last Resort, War with North Korea, which sets up this conversation perfectly. And you can find a link to her piece on our website, onpointradio.org. Helene, thanks for joining me.
Hey, Harwood. How you doing?
Good. I should note that Helene and I have worked together for a long time.
Oh, sorry. I'm supposed to say John.
Yeah, that's okay. Helene, I want to set up this first, my first question with a clip from President Trump talking at Camp David. When a reporter asked if he'd be open to talks with Kim Jong-un, he said, sure, I'm always open to talking. And then he went on to say this.
He knows I'm not messing around. I'm not messing around. Not even a little bit. Not even 1%. He understands that. At the same time, if we can come up with a very peaceful and very good solution, we're working on it with Rex. We're working on it with a lot of people. If something can happen and something can come out of those talks, that would be a great thing for all of humanity.
So, Helene, with the president speaking like that, with him having earlier undercut Secretary of State Tillerson, is it clear to the Pentagon and the U.S. military what the U.S. policy is at this moment?
No, it's not clear to the Pentagon, and I don't think it's about as clear to the Pentagon as it is to most Americans. You know, there's talk, and then there is reality. Certainly in, you know, all things being equal, the United States does have a bigger button, if you want to call it that, than North Korea, and a much bigger military and a much bigger nuclear arsenal. But that kind of talk disguises the plain facts on the ground, which is that North Korea has the capability to retaliate. It's very close to the DMZ that straddles North and South Korea, is a demilitarized zone in name only. It's loaded up with a lot of artillery, and Seoul is very close to Pyongyang and to the DMZ. So American allies, South Korean residents, Japanese citizens would all be very much in harm's way if there was a war on the Korean Peninsula. There's no mistake about that, which is one of the reasons why a lot of this talk about we can hit North Korea, sure we can, but it's not going to be something that would be without its consequences, and that's something that's very much on the minds of people at the Pentagon.
So describe what you found and reported on with your colleagues for this story about quiet preparations. It seemed clear that the military was trying to do some things without shouting about it too loudly to avoid ratcheting up concerns or tensions.
Yes.
and unintended consequences in North Korea.
Exactly. There's a lot of concern about the military that if you start a war drumbeat, you make something seem inevitable. But at the same time, there's concern at the military about not being ready. For the past 16, 17 years, you've had an American military that has been fighting counterinsurgency, counterinsurgents all around the world. Basically, we've been going after Taliban, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Al-Shabaab, Islam. We've been fighting a very particular kind of war. It's one that's not going after great states or great nations, but one that's going after individual targets around the world. And that's what the military has become used to.
That was the paradigm shift we were told was permanent.
Exactly. But you have military leaders now who are very worried that after almost two decades of this, we've kind of, General Milley, the head, the Army Chief of Staff, calls it a loss of muscle memory. We've kind of forgotten how to fight the great power land battles, you know, the sort of thing that you saw in World War II, where you have a big state-sponsored adversary that has its own air defense system and has its own military and its own capabilities. And so this is something that you have American commanders on the ground very worried about in the, you know, in the event that the military, the American military is called to go to war in North Korea. So a lot of the exercises that you see at the Pentagon now are centered around how to get that muscle memory back.
And some of those are taking place in the United States, right? You described an operation, I think, in the state of Utah.
In Nevada.
Nevada, sorry.
There were two in December, one in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and one in Nevada. These are all part of normally scheduled exercises. The military is constantly in training. They're always preparing for stuff. But what happened this time around because of North Korea is that added elements were added to these exercises. There were more cargo planes. They were bigger than before. There's more a sense now of urgency to a lot of what you're seeing. And there's a return now to how do you prepare for a great powers war as opposed to the counterinsurgency stuff that we've been doing for so long.
Now, we've heard a lot of talk throughout the Trump administration of various cabinet members trying to manage a president who is not only new to politics, but he has a volatile personality, erratic, you could say, certainly from his public statements and what we've seen reported about his behavior. Is the way the Pentagon is going about this in any way tailored to the president, to that audience of one that we hear about with other parts of the government?
I think there's a part of that as well. Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis has, among all of the cabinet members, shown a deftness at how to handle President Trump that you don't see with so many others. He's certainly got President Trump's respect, and there's a lot of deference that the president has given to Mr. Mattis. I think part of what you're seeing now is the military figuring out how to present the president with his set of military options, which are always going to be on the table, while at the same time calling for diplomacy. You never hear Mr. Mattis saying anything about war with North Korea that doesn't come accompanied by him calling for diplomacy and calling for, you know, return to the diplomatic track, sticking to the diplomatic track. General Dunford, who's the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in much the same way, has constantly urged that we stick to diplomacy. And that's because both of these men and most of these commanders know what the cost of a war in North Korea would be. This would not be the same thing as going into Iraq or hitting ISIS targets in Syria or attacking Afghanistan. These were barely, you know, Iraq in 2003, sure, they had a military, but they didn't have, the first thing we did was knock out their air defense. So we went in there, and the skies above Iraq were largely unchallenged by, you know, any Iraqi air defense systems. The United States pilots and F-16s and F-18s ruled the skies above Iraq. This would not be the case with North Korea. You have a much more well-developed military there. You have a much more sophisticated military, and you have one that's been training for years for exactly this sort of thing. So it's a much, and on top of that is their nuclear arsenal. So much of the stuff that they've got that we're worried about is buried, and we don't know where all of it is. So they have the capability to retaliate, even if we went with a first strike option, a limited strike option, or the punch in the nose.
The bloody nose option.
Yeah, the bloody nose option. You're not going to be able to take out all that they have right away. And so that means they have all these long-range artillery positions that are very close to the DMZ, and they could hit Seoul, and they could hit other parts of South Korea and even Japan very quickly before we can take out everything they have. So then you have to start asking yourself, what sort of civilian casualties really count, are we willing to put up with? And that takes you into really, really dangerous territory. And that's why nobody at the Pentagon really wants to do this. But at the same time, you do have to get prepared. And when you have the sort of rhetoric that we've been hearing over the years coming from President Trump and from Kim Jong-un, you can't have a military that's not getting ready for this. But at the same time, it really is kind of an unthinkable war.
Helene, I remember before the two wars that we've recently fought with Iraq, there were major troop mobilizations and people could see this happening. Should the average American feel that this situation isn't getting super serious until we start to see some of that, or will we not see it in this instance?
That's a great question. It's not so much the mobilization, the troop mobilizations that I would say would be the sort of canary in a coal mine, is the evacuations of Americans. You have, their estimates are range from 200,000 Americans in South Korea all the way to a million. You would have to see wholesale travel warnings, evacuations of Americans there, and that sort of thing before, you know, I would think in a normal administration before you would start worrying about that we're about to see some kind of military action. But that's sort of where it does feel a little bit as if we're in a different time now, and President Trump has been very unpredictable. And so that's sort of the you know, our president is the wild card in the situation.
Helene, you mentioned the diplomatic options, which Mattis constantly talks about. Where does Secretary of State Tillerson fit into all this? There's been so much speculation that he's going to leave his job. Is he a key player in this situation?
He is. I mean, they're having there's a diplomatic meeting that's going on right now as we speak in Vancouver. These talks are ongoing, and you have all of the people who were part of the Korean War have joined. You have the Brits, the Canadians have joined. Secretary of State Tillerson and Secretary of Defense Mattis was there last night as well, and they've been having talks. You're going to see continued call for more sanctions out of the
UN. So he counts.
Yeah, he does count. He is definitely still a voice in the administration when it comes to North Korea, and he's definitely been on the side of, you know, Mattis urging to a continuation of this diplomatic track.
Helene Cooper, Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for talking. It was a pleasure talking to you, John.
Okay. I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
Hey, it's Maria Hinojosa, host of NPR's Latino USA, the podcast that takes you inside the Latino conversation. Each week, we'll take you into one story that will fascinate and often surprise you. Listen to Latino USA on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood. We're talking about the challenge the U.S. military faces with North Korea now, preparing for a horrifying conflict without raising the chance it will happen. In a moment, we'll talk to a former military planner and a military journalist. But first, let's remember what happened in Hawaii on Saturday. An alert was sent out ordering people to take shelter for an imminent missile strike. What did it feel like to be there? Susan Purnell, who runs a jewelry business in Salisbury, Maryland, was on a tourist trip to the Hawaii island of Kauai when the alert went out. Full disclosure, Susan's a family friend of mine. Now, today she's back home and joins me. Susan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. Hi.
Let me first set the scene by playing the message that residents and visitors to Hawaii heard over their television sets on Saturday morning after an employee, state employee, mistakenly sent out a missile alert.
The U.S. Pacific Command has detected a missile threat to Hawaii. A missile may impact on land or sea within minutes. This is not a drill. If you are indoors, stay indoors. If you are outdoors, seek immediate shelter in a building. Remain indoors, well away from windows. If you are driving, pull safely to the side of the road and seek shelter in a building or lay on the floor. We will announce when the threat has ended.
And then I want to play one more clip, which is Hawaii resident Lori Callies recalling the panic she and her elderly mother felt during that false missile alert. She was on CBS Sunday Morning.
My 95-year-old mother, who we were not going to say anything to until we had all the information, who lives in a retirement community here, called us on the phone and she said, "I can't get on the floor. I can't get on the floor." And she survived Pearl Harbor.
So, Susan, you were there having fun on a long tourist trip. Tell me how you received this news and what did it feel like? What did you do?
Well, we got the message on our cell phones. At around 8 o'clock that a ballistic missile threat was inbound, seek immediate shelter. We thought at first, this is a hoax. This can't possibly be real. So we were out to try to find out if it was real or not. So we called the front desk at the resort where we were staying. No answer. Then we called the concierge, and he said, "Get into a room without windows right away. That's all we know. Get into a room." So we grabbed everything, pillows and blankets and all the water that we had left. It was our last day, so we had no food. And we went to the one room, the bathroom, that didn't have windows, and we hunkered down. It's so interesting, John, because I had never thought what I would do if I only had several minutes of my life left. And at that point, I really thought that was the case.
So you weren't walking through this the way we used to do in school when a fire alarm was pulled and you don't know if anything's seriously happening or not, but you're going through the motions anyway. You felt this was real and something that would change or end your life.
I did, because it said this is not a drill. And then when we turned on the TV, we got the same message that you just ran prior to my coming on. And so I thought for sure it was real. And so, you know, the first thought is survival. Let's get into the room. And I said, if this is a nuclear missile, no bathroom is going to save us from it. You know, we got kind
I
of,
think not.
This is not going to work. Right. So it was interesting. There were four of us. The two girls began calling their families, and the two guys were going through their phones trying to see Twitter and seek out any news sources that might tell them whether this was real or not.
What did you say in the conversations with your families?
Well, I first called my son and told him I just need to hear his voice, and I wanted to tell him that something had happened that was scaring us and that we were in a bunker, meaning a bathroom. And I just wanted to tell him I loved him and how proud I was of the person he had become. And I got pretty teary-eyed, and he stayed on the phone with me for a while, and then I realized I wanted to call my sister, so I called her as well and asked her if she'd heard anything, and she hadn't heard anything. But then she got on Twitter and everything else and stayed on the phone with me. And it took, I think we were in, well, they say it was 38 minutes between the time that we heard the first alarm and we finally got the second message, which said, there is no missile threat. Repeat, there is no missile threat, false alarm. So it was about 38 minutes that we were just...
And you got that news from the television?
No, it came again to our phones.
Mm-hmm.
We got it. We got a second message sent to our phones that there was no missile threat. We weren't near a television at that point. We really were in the bathroom, all four of us. I was sitting in the tub.
I got to say, it made the thought of that phone call to your son makes me emotional thinking about... what that would be like if you were actually terrified. You know, we there's so much information ricocheting around American society about things that are dangerous and things that are threats, but you think most of them aren't real.
Right.
That must have been an unbelievable, agonizing 38 minutes.
It really was a long 38 minutes, and strangely, I wasn't really worried about my own death. I mean, as my dad said right before he died, I've had a good run and I'm not that worried. I mean, I thought, well, after 2 weeks in paradise, maybe I'm going to see another kind of paradise. I mean, I just really wasn't worried about myself, but I was sad thinking that I might not have the chance to see or talk to my loved ones again. And I really just didn't know what to do but just to keep talking to them.
What did it feel like and what did you do when you got the all clear?
We got out of the bathroom. And we went about our day. But I was shaky, and I still am shaky a little bit. It was very scary. You know, most people, you know, you think about death and you think of lingering deaths where you have a chance to sort of think and come to grips with everything, or you think about accidents where you die right away. But you don't think about a situation where somebody's going to say, you got 10 or 15 minutes to live. And that's what we were in.
Susan, I want to play, before I let you go, one more piece of sound. And this is the Homeland Security Secretary, Nielsen, who told Fox News Sunday she hopes people won't draw the wrong conclusion from this false missile alert in Hawaii.
I would hate for anybody not to abide by alert and warnings coming from government systems. They can trust government systems. We test them every day. This was a very unfortunate mistake, but these alerts are vital. Seconds and minutes can save lives.
Susan, do you still trust government warning systems?
Well, it's hard to believe that a mistake like this can be made, that one guy saying, yes, I want to send this message is all it took. Hopefully they'll put in some safeguard measures that will allow two people at least to agree to send the message out. Yes, I'm going to always err on the side of caution. And if somebody tells me to go into a shelter, I'm going to go into a shelter.
Susan, I hope that nobody ever tells you to do that again, and it doesn't become necessary for any of us. Thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you, John.
Okay. Now, joining me now from Washington is retired Special Forces Colonel David Maxwell. He served five tours in South Korea, including as Director of Plans, Policy, and Strategy for the Special Operations Command in Korea. Today, he's a fellow at the Institute for Korean American Studies and a member of the Board of Directors of the International Council of Korean Studies. David, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, John. It's very nice to be here.
Also from Washington, we're joined by Patrick Tucker, technology editor at Defense One, and we've put links to some of his reporting on this story at our website, onpointradio.org. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, thanks for having me, John.
David, let me talk with you. If you're in the U.S. military and you don't know which way policy is headed, what is the prudent thing to do, and do you see the Pentagon doing those things?
Well, first and foremost, the U.S. military must deter an attack on South Korea. That is really the prime directive. And, of course, for the last 65 years, we have successfully deterred a resumption of hostilities. So the military has to ensure it has the forces ready and that they are well-trained and prepared to demonstrate its capability in order to deter an attack. On the other hand, given this situation, the uncertainty of the Korean Peninsula, it wants to enhance its forces. And most importantly, it must be able to provide military options to the National Command Authority, to the Secretary of Defense and the President, should something happen. So the military is looking to enhance its capabilities to deter, but also to provide capabilities to decision makers so that they have options that range from, of course, defending and fighting and winning a war, to contingency operations, to perhaps take out a missile if the intelligence shows that there is a nuclear missile that's being, or a nuclear warhead being mated to a missile. And then we have to be able to act in self-defense to defend our nation.
Patrick, let me ask you, as someone who is very knowledgeable about military technology, you know, the average person thinks North Korea is a small, poor country. We're the most powerful country on Earth, vastly bigger button than the North Koreans have in the lexicon that President Trump was using the other day. Does the U.S. have the capability of striking North Korea militarily and preventing a catastrophic response from North Korea in terms of preventing huge damage to Americans and South Koreans in Seoul and around Seoul, preventing a strike, an intercontinental strike, if that capability actually exists or not? Is this going to be a lose-lose proposition regardless?
we do have the capability to make specific targeted strikes that would probably decimate the ability of the North Koreans to launch an ICBM, a mid-range, or a short range. But pulling that off, the timing, that's something that we've never done before. You can drill against it, but, you know, the North Koreans are prepared to launch a lot of weapons at South Korea, firstly, and perhaps mid-range weapons aimed at Guam or Japan. We've advertised our ability to intercept at least some of those, and we've also advertised our ability to intercept an ICBM, but none of this has actually been tested in real life. So we do have the capability to make a strategic strike to decimate their capability to wage warfare, and we have some high confidence levels about what sort of response we might see in return, but it's not surgery. This is a difficult adversary. They have integrated air defenses, as we pointed out. They have anti-aircraft missile batteries, so it would be a operation that was heavily reliant probably on stealth aircraft. There would probably be a ground invasion component to it. And while we have an understanding of where their military capabilities lie in their ability to attack South Korea, Guam, Japan, and the United States, this is a regime that has also become expertant at avoiding U.S. aerial satellite surveillance. This is something, this is the weird cat and mouse game that we're constantly engaged with them in. So we would win, and we are ready for a major strike on North Korea. But how the sort of casualties that might come as a result of that, the sort of attacks that they might launch, we can speculate with certain degrees of confidence, but we can't know for certain.
Colonel Maxwell, what's your level of confidence that the United States could hit North Korea without provoking a response that would involve catastrophic loss of life?
Well, of course, one of the truisms of war is chance and uncertainty, the fog and friction of war. We can make predictions all we want, but I guarantee that the opposite is likely to happen. So I don't think that I think that if we attack them, there is likely that there will be some kind of response and up to and including a catastrophic response. If Kim Jong-un fears for the safety, the survival of his regime, his only option may be to execute his campaign plan to unify the peninsula by force in order to ensure regime survival. That's the worst case. Now, he's not going to be successful, but that may be his only option. You know, what will prevent him from doing that is his calculus that the combined Korean, South Korean, and U.S. forces are superior, and that he, and what deters him is that he cannot attack into strength. And so that's one of the reasons why you see the combined military forces, just not the U.S., but the South Korean and U.S. forces training, exercising, and preparing forces. Now, the other scenario to consider is, everybody talks about the bloody nose scenario and we worry about the catastrophic response. Kim Jong-un is playing the long game. And while regime survival is the vital national interest of the Kim family regime, unification of the peninsula is required in their calculus to ensure regime survival. And so the North has been executing a strategy that's based on subversion, coercion, and if necessary, they will use force to unify the peninsula. Now, if we conduct a catastrophic a strike against their missile targets, given the political situation between South Korea and the U.S., Kim Jong-un may use that as an opportunity to try to drive that wedge between the ROK-U.S. alliance. He really has to split the ROK-U.S. alliance in order to achieve long-term success. And now we, of course, see the talks between North and South, and there is, of course, speculation that he is trying to drive that wedge between North and South. You know, we've heard President Moon say that there can be no war without his approval. And if we conduct a unilateral strike against North Korean targets, that, from Kim Jong-un's mind, may create the friction necessary for the alliance to weaken, if not to dissolve, which would be in his interest. And that's one thing that could prevent him from a catastrophic response.
I want to go to the phones. We've got a caller on the line, Jake from Peterborough, New Hampshire. Jake, welcome to On Point. Go right ahead.
Hello, John. Thanks for taking my call. Gentlemen, thanks for your insightful input to the conversation. My concern, as a 21-year veteran, I was a fighter pilot the entire time. I was a wild weasel, which meant my job was to go get shot at by integrated air defense systems and respond, which I did every night of Desert Storm, is that we're painting this North Korean military. The previous speaker referred to a war of great powers. Certainly a threat and certainly a powerful regime. But when I left the military, a North Korean fighter pilot was flying about 5 hours a year. We have defectors that are coming over the border malnourished and with diseases that make them pretty much incapable of staging any kind of really good offensive or defense. I'm happy to hear the speakers now say that if there is the capability, and should we learn that there's the capability for the latest of the madmen in the Kim regime, placing a nuclear warhead on a missile that can even be guided. And as far as I can tell from my avocational study, we have not seen any missiles really guided. They've kind of pointed them and shot them, sort of like the wacky Iraqi science fair we had.
Jake, we're running out of time. I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.
Hello, just dropping in to remind you about Here and Now. We cover the day's most essential news with context so you know the why and what's next. A fast-paced snapshot of the world every day. Listen to Here and Now on NPR One or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood. We're looking at how the Pentagon is preparing, quietly, for the horrifying prospect of a war with North Korea. My guests are retired Special Forces and former military planner Colonel David Maxwell and Patrick Tucker, technology editor at Defense One. Patrick, let me start with you to respond to Jake, our previous caller, who felt that the discussions of this issue are giving the North Korean military too much credit.
Well, I mean, the definition of what is great power conflict is somewhat subjective, but I think that most people that observe North Korea would agree that it's at very least a frustrating power, and with the potential to be an incredibly frustrating and ultimately exhausting power if we were to, depending on the sort of conflict that we engaged with them. So their integrated air defense systems are probably superior to that of Saddam Hussein in the early 2000s, but not on the par with a real access area denial A2AD type of system that you'd see in China or Russia. But, you know, we're also talking about the possibility of prolonged warfare in subterranean tunnels. We're not sure of all the targets that we would hit as part of an operation. And if that operation is limited to what's been called denuclearization, that's also somewhat subjective. Are we talking about removing permanently their ability to ever have a nuclear weapons program again? Are we talking about setting them back 5 years or 10 years? So they have the potential to be an incredibly stubborn adversary in terms of just preserving their nuclear weapons capability. And an operation from everyone that I've talked to would Mattis has characterized it as catastrophic, and I think that that's probably appropriate. It would be the largest military operation that this country has seen, possibly since World War II, and probably since the first Korean War.
Colonel Maxwell, do we overestimate North Korean capabilities?
Well, I think Jake makes a great point. We should not create North Korea as 10 feet tall, especially since their enlistment minimum enlistment height is about 4 feet 6 inches tall. Their growth is stunted. So, but they have one large advantage. That's the size of their military. You know, Stalin said quantity has a quality all its own. It's the fourth largest military in the world. And if they attack, they are not going to win. They are going to inflict great damage, and significant blood and treasure will be expended if they attack. To Jake's point, though, if North Korea attacks, the combined South Korean and U.S. militaries are going to do two things initially. And from an air power perspective, first, they are going to go after that integrated air defense system. They are going to go after the 12,000 artillery pieces that North Korea has, and hundreds of them ranging Seoul. So there will be the counterfire fight. Both ground artillery and U.S. and South Korean air power will go against that. And Jake will be happy to know that his fellow fighter pilots, I think that every pilot on the Korean Peninsula when the war starts will soon become an ace. As he noted, you know, less than 5 hours of training time for the North Korean Air Force, they will be no match to the air combat capabilities of U.S. and South Korean pilots. And I'm afraid that U.S. pilots deploying from the United States – will, by the time they get there, we'll have no more air targets, and they will be concentrating on ground attack against North Korean mobile and dug-in forces.
Colonel Maxwell, John, could I go ahead. Add one last thing to that? There's another big advantage that the North Koreans have that we haven't really dealt with as a force in a very long time, and that is that our intelligence picture over North Korea and through North Korea is not what it is for really any other country that we consider a peer adversary or a competitor or a direct adversary. We don't have great human intelligence into North Korea except for these defectors. These aren't guys that are, you know, hanging around European capitals chatting a lot. It's very hard to get a picture of, you know, what's going on inside military planning in North Korea. They don't produce a lot of signals intelligence. It's a country with basically the IT of, you know, 1994. There's not a lot of chatter about that we can easily intercept. So we're kind of reliant on satellite imagery. They understand this. And so there's a lot of their military response and also their nuclear weapons capability that's subterranean and that we would be trying to gain an intelligence picture of at the same time as we're fighting. It's certainly doable, but it's hugely frustrating. And that's something that it also goes into the planning and the caution about this.
All right, let's go back to the phones.
If I could add one point on this that I didn't cover, one big threat that we have not prepared for is the chemical and biological threat. We talk about the nuclear threat, but we estimate anywhere between 2,500 and 5,000 tons of chemical weapons. And we have seen Kim Jong-un's willingness to use VX, one of the most dangerous, deadly chemical agents, you know, on his half-brother. And so if they launch artillery with chemical rounds, that is another factor that has to be planned for, and it will have devastating effects on military forces and the civilian population.
All right. Let's go to the phones. We've got Bradley on the line from Madison, Wisconsin. Bradley, welcome to On Point. Go right ahead.
Hi, John. So, yeah, I'd just like to make a comment and get your feedback on your opinion on how come you think President Trump has been erratic or, as you said, unpredictable in his response towards North Korea. I think from the get-go, since he's taken office, he's been stern with Kim Jong. And I like it. Sometimes he may not come out the most politically correct, but he most of the time what most all Americans can understand. So just wondering why you feel that way.
Bradley, thanks so much for your call. Colonel Maxwell, what do you think? Do you think that President Trump's handling of the situation has been steady and desirable?
It is certainly unconventional, and it has, you know, obviously causes concern because we have never had a president who speaks like this. I will say that I think, from what I have heard from people near the administration, the president views North Korea as the top foreign policy problem for his administration. I think that one of the things that he has tried to do, perhaps inarticulate, you know, or in ways that conventional foreign policy experts would like to have happen, but he has tried to demonstrate that we have military capabilities and he has the will to use them if necessary. And so I think that, you know, as everybody talks about, there are no good military options, which there's never a good military option because people will suffer regardless of what kind of military option is executed. But I think that he wants to portray to Kim Jong-un that we have the strength, the capability, and the will to use our military power if he acts in a way that directly threatens the American homeland, the American people, and our allies. And that, in a conventional way, should set the foundation for diplomatic action. And I think that if we have a strong and capable military that that demonstrates its strength, then that gives Kim Jong-un pause. It deters a conventional attack on the South, and it should give Secretary Tillerson and the diplomats room to maneuver to try to, you know, as we would say, it's better to jaw-jaw than war-war.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Mike on the line and second caller from Madison, Wisconsin. Mike, welcome to the show. Go right ahead.
Yes, thank you very much. If the United States military doesn't have at least a dozen THAAD missile defense systems set up along Hawaii to defend the state of Hawaii, well, shame on them, and there should be somebody going to court if even a single missile comes anywhere near the state of Hawaii. And you talk about showing how powerful the United States military is, well, then why are we allowing the North Korean military to test fire all of these ballistic missiles? We should be knocking them out of the sky once they go beyond 20 or 30 miles of the country's border. You want to show how strong our military is, put the THAAD defense system in play and knock those things out before he gets any further refinement of his systems.
Mike, thanks so much for your call. Patrick, is he right? Do we have those defense systems for Hawaii? And if not, should we?
We should. I'll put it that way. The THAAD, or the Terminal High Air Defense System, that is more for short-range missiles. That's going to be for while it's called a high-altitude system, it's not for something that's going to hit the atmosphere. It's for mostly South Korea or short-term targets. Now, in terms of defending against those mid-range targets and those outer mid-range to long-range targets, Hawaii would possibly be outer edge to of mid-range to long-range. We have some stuff in the works. So we have a new missile called the SM-3, number 2A, I guess, is the full one. We deploy it on these warships called Aegis destroyers. Traditionally, you've used these for fleet defense. So somebody fires a missile at your fleet. This thing, you throw one of these out and it intercepts it in the air. In February of 2017, they demonstrated that they could actually use that to intercept missiles that weren't headed for the fleet. So you've got Aegis warships that can do that. Full deployment of that happens in 2018. We're also modernizing the ground-based interceptors that are actually mostly in Alaska, because the trajectory of a missile out of North Korea would head over Alaska.
Patrick, what about lasers? Is that Star Wars movie stuff, or is there real technology that is usable in the near term?
Yeah, there is a program called the LAWS, or the Low Power Air Weapons System, and the objective of the program is by the year 2020 to outfit a drone, a UAV, a big one, but one that would probably get through an older radar air defense system, about the size of an Avenger, if you like that sort of thing, kind of like a Cessna-sized drone with a 30-kilowatt laser. And the point is, and here's the entire future of, like, you know, missile defense, how to think about this. We don't have great window into how well we can intercept missiles when they're at their highest point. And intercepting a missile that's shot out of North Korea that's headed, say, for the United States would probably involve trying to intercept it over Russia, which brings a whole lot of other political considerations. If you can intercept the missile when it's closest to the platform during what's called the boost phase, then you greatly increase your probability of hitting it. And that means using perhaps stealth aircraft armed with lasers, or small missiles, or even drones armed with lasers or small missiles, and getting them real close. We are building the ability to do that, and it's something that you're going to see in the next few years between 2020 and 2025. But the military underestimated the pace by which the North Korean nuclear weapons program would advance. So these are a few years behind, and military leaders will say that. They'll say that we're late to need on some of these capabilities, and it's a point of frustration.
I want to go back to the phones. We've got Angela on the line from Portland, Maine. Angela, welcome to the show. What's your question?
Thank you. Hi, John. I have a comment and a question. I think that we're kind of in a situation where it's like the emperor's new clothing. No one's really coming out and saying it. All the officials, and we're directly involved in this now because of the lack of maturity of this so-called president. All the other presidents have seemed to be able to use diplomacy. He talks about diplomacy, but that's an oxymoron. He does not know how to be diplomatic, and he doesn't have the vocabulary to be diplomatic. My children had better vocabulary by second grade. So my, that's a comment. So this is directly his fault. My second thing is a question. You've mentioned it more than once, that our military is quietly getting ready. Do you really believe, does anybody truly believe there's a way to be quiet about this in today's world? Just us sitting on the radio discussing all the little details of warfare and missiles and...
Angela, that's a great question. I'm going to go to Colonel Maxwell on that. Colonel, is it possible with today's communications technology and media system for the military to quietly prepare legitimately?
Well, I think you're really asking secretly. That's what I think.
Yes.
I think we are doing it quietly, but can we keep a secret? And I think the caller is correct. It's very difficult to do in today's information environment. I would suggest, though, that we as Americans, if we are going to use military force, it's imperative that in our democracy that we debate these issues and that the public is aware of them. But I think the caller is right. It is very difficult to do things in secret, especially when you are talking about the movements and activities of large amounts of conventional forces. You know, back in Desert Storm, the press used to watch the pizza deliveries to the Pentagon to know that that something was brewing. But now everybody with a cell phone can be at any military base and see military movements to airfields, to trains, loading ships. And anybody with a cell phone can take a picture and put that on the internet. So,
Colonel, let me ask you a big picture question. We've been watching a succession of administrations deal with North Korea. What would you say is your personal comfort level with our preparation now with this military, this administration, compared to the Obama administration, the George W. Bush administration, the Bill Clinton administration?
I have high confidence. I think that when you look at General Brooks in Korea, what he is asking for, what he is doing. Of course, we've talked about Secretary Mattis, his leadership, General Dunford and the chairman. I think that they are doing what they can to prepare the forces. They are taking prudent measures. And I think that through any administration, while there will be critiques of presidents, the military is going to do its job. And I have high confidence if there is a war that is initiated by North Korea, we will defend South Korea, and the South Korean and U.S. forces will defeat North Korean forces, will prevail, and ultimately there will be a return to a unified Korea, which has to be the ultimate long-term, acceptable, durable political arrangement that will serve our interests.
And that will be the last word. Retired Colonel David Maxwell, former military planner in Korea, Patrick Tucker, technology editor at Defense One, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.